There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, Little Atoms magazine editor Padre Greedy talks to Harry Kunsrew about his latest novel, White Tears. Harry Kunsrew is the author of the novels The Impressionist, Transmission, My Revolutions and Gods Without Men, as well as the story collection Noise. His latest novel is White Tears.
Welcome to the Atoms, Harry Kunsrew. We're here to talk about White Tears, and I'll let you maybe briefly, before we go into the nitty-gritty of it, maybe briefly describe what the book is about.
It's about two young white record producers in New York who fake a 1920s blues record. Mm-hmm. And, they put this out. They have a production business that is based on giving a kind of retro analog sound to the bands that they work with. And they're very interested in the past rather than, the future. And they put this out as a sort of calling card for their thing. They hope to fool some people and show how clever they are and how much they understand the aesthetic of this old music. And a collector gets in touch with them, an old man gets in touch with them to say, well, where did you find this record? And they say, well, we made it up, more fool you. And he says, well, no, you didn't. I haven't heard this record since 1959. And at that point, it opens up the possibility that instead of inventing something, they've actually channeled something from the past that wants to come back out into the present.
The narrator, Seth, he meets Carter, who's obsessive music producer at university. And in some ways, it's a kind of familiar story of a slightly innocent narrator, kind of a Brideshead-ish or Gatsby, even kind of innocent character thrown into this world of complexity and above all wealth, actually. Carter and his family are incredibly wealthy people.
Yeah, it is a story about inherited wealth and about generational inheritance as well. And much of the story turns on things that Carter's ancestors have done in the past and the origin of this fortune. And these two young guys are not unlike many of their peers. They're New York hipsters, and Carter is turning the family's capital into cultural capital. And like a lot of people in places like London and New York, they don't feel very connected to the sources of the money that they're deploying in order to get this access to culture. Certainly Carter feels not connected to the South, which is his family's roots are in the South. And mm-hmm. And his interest in black music and the blues is a sort of sign of fashionability rather than any kind of deeper engagement with the history and the context out of which that music comes.
But there is still a sense where Carter, ironically, sees, even though he has doesn't feel any connection, is still in this dreadful hunt for authenticity in music and that rarity. What does that say about him?
Well, I've always written a great deal about authenticity. Mm. I mean, it's something I've always turned over in my mind, partly because of my own slightly kind of complicated position. I often joke that I'm the most inauthentic person I know, partly because my father comes from India, my mum comes from the UK. I'm not white enough, I'm not brown enough. Mm-hmm. I've always been very aware of my identity as something that is constructed, something that is to some extent performed, and that, you know, you code switch a little bit and I am interested in the reverse of that perception, where a lot of people feel in a very unproblematic way that they are who they are, and that there is a sort of naturalness to their, and an authenticity to their personal identity. And people are encouraged to seek authenticity in various ways in the culture. You know, I mean, it's a throwaway word, you know, it's a word for something that is good. But for a young rich guy like Carter, it's my observation that often money makes the world rather thin and makes things rather kind of interchangeable. People who haven't earned their own money sometimes find everything a bit disposable, and that's a kind of troubling experience. You know, if you can make anything happen, then nothing is more important than anything else. And he's troubled by that, and his interest in Black musical culture is very wrapped up with a search for a kind of rootedness and thickness to experience that he doesn't feel he has. And he has a really problematic notion of Blackness as authenticity. And especially, you know, you think about the blues and what the blues signifies in popular culture now. And it's the go-to thing for the beer commercial where, you know, if you want to signify the real America, or you want to say, you know, rootsiness, you know, you have a blues guitar or a harmonica. And you know, there are endless layers of complexity to how this music actually came about. And there's no, you know, the image of the Black bluesman as, you know, ultimate primitive authentic figure is a really, really fake one, is an inauthentic image. And this is why it's very interesting to me to think about a young white wealthy guy who is interested in the most authentic music it is possible to be interested in, and because it opens up this fascinating ambiguity about realness and fakeness and the construction of authenticity.
What I found interesting was the sense that authenticity comes with a narrowing almost always. So Seth, the narrator, starts off and he's very interested in techno, which is a music of the future, essentially. And he's gradually weaned off it almost by Carter, who's saying, no, this isn't right. And Carter starts off playing hip-hop in university gigs and kind of DJing, and his DJing gradually wheedles down to, you know, just 20s records. There's an interesting element. I remember reading an interview with Philoella Benjamin, of all people, is in The Guardian a while back, and they had the stock question of, if you could live in any time, when would it be? And she said, I'm not nostalgic because it was never a good time for Black people, so I don't look back to the past. But the way that techno or hip-hop or futuristic Black arts movements are seen as inauthentic almost by Seth and certainly by Carter, how does that why does that happen, and what is there a fear of the contemporary African-American culture as opposed to the
they've got very different stories. Seth the narrator has had some sort of breakdown in his past, or some sort of experience of slipping backwards in time, and is sort of terrified of losing touch with the future. And until he meets Carter, he is very strictly a forward-facing futuristic guy. Like, he wants to listen to futuristic music, and he wants nothing to do with anything that will pull him backwards. And he has a sort of crush on his friend, and his friend is the one who's very interested in all sorts of retro things. And reluctantly, Seth allows himself to be reintroduced to all these older forms of music. But you're very right to bring up that tradition of Black futurism. I mean, there is a sort of pretty well-known canon of futuristic and future-orientated Black music. You think about Sun Ra, who is at the center of all these kind of conversations. You know, his stage persona is as somebody who's from another planet and who's kind of come down to Earth. And you can read this as a sort of escapism and as a sort of critique of the actual social conditions in which this guy has to operate, you know, creating that sort of fantasy. And then later on, there are bands like Parliament, and then later still, there's the canon of Detroit techno people who have a kind of science fiction forward-facing position. I mean, there these days people are beginning to kind of complicate that question, I think, a little bit. I've noticed that Black critics lately are a little bit sick of a sort of straightforward division between black futurism and sort of science fiction music and mm-hmm. something else. I mean, I wish I could remember the name of the piece. There was I think something called kind of the Afrofuturist Manifesto or the Real Afrofuturist Manifesto mm-hmm. that has been circulating a lot. It's an artist's piece with kind of a 20 theses about how you should actually be talking about Afrofuturism, and maybe we can dig it out. It's an interesting thing to read in terms of this business about the future and the past and black music.
Moving along the story, so Seth and Carter finish university, move to Brooklyn. Carter, with his magical ephemeral money, buys a studio, buys a hell of a load of analog equipment, and so on. I just want to read, actually, there's one, as you were saying earlier, there's one about the kind of gaseous air of wealth around Carter. There's a passage where Seth says, "Money was Carter's invisible helper, a friendly ghost making things happen in the background. Cars arrived, restaurant tabs got picked up, and when it was time to change the scenery, money dissolved the city into a beach or a ski lodge. The thing was to never point out it was happening." So, with this invisible air of money, they set up as producers in Brooklyn, and they quickly start recording. And it almost kind of, without insulting Mark Ronson, a kind of Mark Ronson-ish kind of recreation of sounds, and they have people flocking them, kind of girl groups and British bands, and they have a white rapper who Carter, having created this world, feels he can decide is inauthentic at the same time. And this is the point where things go slightly strained, when Carter goes almost entirely off the rails, really.
Because there's no end point to his search for authenticity. You know, he dials up the intensity. So, you know, he firstly, digital equipment is no good. Then, you know, things post-war are no good, and then he's kind of backed himself into this sort of sonic corner where the only thing that is good enough for him to listen to are these 1920s and 30s blues records, and he becomes a collector of these records. And since he has a lot of money, he can afford to acquire them. I mean, they are an extremely expensive thing to decide to collect, certainly these days. You know, the days of digging things up for a few bucks are long gone in the blues 78s world. And, you know, this it's an unachievable quest. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. I mean, the hole he's trying to fill is never going to be filled by anything that he can buy in that way.
So through the very digital tools that he's later trained, he manages to create this. I'm trying not to give too much mm-hmm. of this plot away. Yes. Give him a little way to start, but he manages to create this record that doesn't exist, or apparently doesn't exist, and manages to beat authenticity.
Yeah, he's very proud of it. Yeah. I mean, essentially the ingredients they have are a couple of field recordings. Seth's in the habit of wandering around New York City just recording the ambient noise around mm-hmm. him, and he picks up a singer singing a blues lyric, and then on another file, Carter finds a guitar that seems to mesh, you know, strangely perfectly with the lyric, and they throw those two things together and they throw a lot of crackle and hiss on top of it, and that's their fake. And so that's what they put out, and they certainly for Carter it's a kind of prank, and it's a sign that he really does own this stuff, like mm-hmm. you know, I can actually make this, and you feel like it's the real thing. And that's, you know, to him that's a victory. And but the book goes in a different direction, this sort of supernatural direction, which opens up, you know, a lot of ambiguities about this, and how have they found these things, how is this record made itself known to them.
So Carter puts the record online onto a collector's site, and they're immediately contacted by character of Jump Jim, mm-hmm. who wants to know where the record's from and claims to know about the record. Tell us a little bit about the character of Jump Jim.
Well, he's from a generation of older blues collectors. I mean, one of the things that is fascinating about diving into this part of the culture is understanding how our contemporary taste for the blues came about. And, you know, these are records that were made in the 20s and 30s. They were distributed in a very kind of haphazard, rather sort of throwaway way. They were not high culture. They weren't even very popular culture. They were, you know, they were marginal things even at the time. You know, the mainstream in the 20s and 30s was listening to sort of jazz bands mm-hmm. and things that were kind of coming out of New York, and these You know, one interesting fact that kind of illustrates how marginal all this stuff was is that one of the biggest labels is a label called Paramount that was actually run by a furniture company out of Wisconsin. And their business model was selling gramophones to people, and they just wanted some records to, to go along with the gramophone. And they were absolutely pragmatic about what they recorded. You know, if they're trying to sell to people in, West Virginia mountains, they're going to do fiddle tunes. You know, if they're trying to sell to people in Mississippi, they're going to record blues. So a lot of these guys had got onto record almost by chance, and they were singing often in styles that were considered old-fashioned in the cities even at the time. Then it all disappears, taste moves on, record production gets almost shut down by the Second World War, and then after the Second World War in New York, a bunch of collectors who are jazz collectors, people who are kind of interested in the sort of New Orleans, Jelly Roll Morton kind of sound, start to find these records, and a particularly intriguing character called James McCune, an eccentric loner guy who did live in the Y in Williamsburg, and announced that this was the most important kind of American music, and he gathered a group of people around him, and they started to take an interest in trying to reconstruct what had actually been recorded and who had been out there. And really nothing was known at that point. It was incredibly obscure. You know, obviously there's no internet, there's no books, there's no real, even the labels hadn't kept proper records of what they'd made. And some of these guys started to go down south and go door to door, knocking on doors in black neighborhoods, asking whether there were records, old records for sale. And it's interesting to me that this was happening absolutely at the same time as the sort of civil rights movement was on, and there were people going door to door to register people to vote. It's an intriguing thing to imagine these kind of white boys going around these different neighborhoods at the same time as other people are doing the same thing for different purposes. And the result of this was that a lot of music got rediscovered. This is when, the culture discovers Robert Johnson and Charlie Patton and people who are considered extraordinarily important now. And then there was a sort of gateway drug, really, which was a guy called Harry Smith, a Greenwich Village bohemian and collector called Harry Smith, persuaded Moses Ash at Folkways Records to put out a compilation of his record collection, actually called Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music. And Smith was an eccentric and something of an occultist, and he wrote these extraordinary liner notes which made the case for this as a sort of, cosmic lost key to the American spirit. And this 3 or 4 LP set started circulating and falls into the hands of people like Dave Van Ronk and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, and these singers start to perform this music. It's not just blues, it's a lot of other kinds of 20s and 30s music as well. And so suddenly there's a taste amongst left-leaning white college-educated northerners for this music of the rural black south, and that's wrapped up with their political aspirations, it's wrapped up with ideas about civil rights. And people eventually dig up some of these old singers who, turn out to some of them to be still alive and available for doing college tours. So there is this sort of moment where people like Mississippi John Hurt and Son House are old men, and they're making money by playing to these all white audiences, or these largely white audiences. And there's a queasiness to that. There's a famous photograph of John Hurt, who is it's a very sweet faced elderly man in a pair of overalls playing his guitar, and there's a sort of buzz cut sort of young white man with his arm around him looking sort of moonily at him, but also in a kind of sort of, it's an odd expression on his face. I mean, all the things about race and class are just vividly present in this blues revival moment. And so Jump Jim the Collector is from that generation, and he narrates some of the stories of what it was like being a young guy discovering this music and a young collector discovering this music, and his relationship with an older, very acquisitive, quite James McCune-ish collector. Yeah. And so my interest is in the collecting culture as much as it is in the way the music was produced, because they are very eccentric, these blues collectors, and they have a lot of power in a certain way, in that unlike record collectors who specialize in later stuff, there are no masters available. There's no, if you have the cleanest copy of a Tommy Johnson record, you're the man.
Yeah.
People have to come to you to remaster it and put it out, and there's a very limited number of people involved in this scene, and by and large they're getting quite old, and people know who has what, and there is scheming to get particular records. And if something turns up, if a new find turns up, it kind of, you know, the news goes around, and people are trying desperately to secure a record that's become available mm-hmm. before. I mean, there's one particular guy at the moment who seems to be richer than all the others. There's a guy called John Tefteller, who I think is in Wisconsin. He's, if he swoops in, he's got more cash, and he will mm-hmm. he will get that record. So if you're trying to keep it out of his hands, you have to do shenanigans, and they do shenanigans.
Of course, there's an exact incident that I'm described in the book, and there were Chester
Bly,
yes, and the immediate rush is to find. So Chester's a fascinating character, actually, but there's an immediate rush after he dies to kind of track down what's happened to his records.
And there is an acquisitiveness. I mean, one of the more famous collectors of this music is Robert Crumb, the cartoonist, Al Crumb, and he, you know, he illustrates a lot of the portraits of old musicians, and there are a couple of self-portraits he's done of himself, either imagining a record he wants to own or having just got hold of something that he wants to own. And he's, you know, he's always quite grotesque in his portraits of himself, but there's this, you know, this is this figure that's sweating and desperate and kind of filled with, you know, anxious energy. And these guys are kind of like that. You know, I made a good friend, a guy called Chris King, who's a serious collector, and he, you know, he read the book and helped me check it through for factual errors. And you know, amusingly, his response was, you know, Harry Crumb is telling it like it is, the record collector. Sort of murderous maniacs.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Natalie Haynes, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Chester, who is kind of Jump Jim's guru, in a sense, or again, his gateway drug into the horror and the fascination of record collection, has some very specific rules, like the right sized record collection and the right period and the right place. But he takes Jump Jim on this acquisitive trip to the South, where he doesn't quite pretend he's a pastor, but doesn't not. Yes, doesn't suggest otherwise when people assume him to be. And I think what's fascinating reading that passage is that I think now enthusiasts for any kind of African-American music would at least pretend to have some concern for African-American culture, where there seemed very little in the post-war collectors. There was no sense of curiosity about the world beyond the records.
Well, I've read statements by some of these guys, you know, and some of them were political. Some of them actually had a great concern for civil rights, or, you know, or just more generally for the culture of the people who made the music. But certainly for some of them, it was actually an escape from the present day, that there was this quality of these sort of ancient mystical voices singing to you out of the crackle. And so they had abstracted that from all the sort of conditions of its production. I mean, there are endless, very interesting stories about song collectors and folklorists, and the very famous father and son, John and Alan Lomax. Mm-hmm. You know, John and Alan Lomax became a researcher of the Library of Congress and was, you know, collected a great deal of field recordings. And so John Lomax's father was a, you know, white Southern gent of the old school, and he was interested in authenticity, and he was interested in getting as far back in time as he could, and he wanted to find the most authentic kind of black song. And he said to himself, well, most blacks have had a corrupting contact with the white world, and so that, you know, and recorded music and popular music. We said, we don't want that. We want people who, you know, are as alienated from the mainstream white world as I can possibly find, because they're the ones who'll have the old folk songs, and they'll know the slave songs, and they'll know the things that I'm looking for, the work, you know, the hollers and the work chants. So he says to himself, where are blacks most cut off from polite society? Prison. And so he goes to Angola with recording equipment, and he goes to Parchman Farm, mm-hmm. and he goes to Sugarland and in Texas, and he's gets access to these incarcerated men and records them in the 1930s. And you can hear on some of the recordings the way he sort of banters with them, and it's very much the, you know, the boss, mm-hmm. talking to his boys. He understands how to talk to them, and they understand how to talk to him. Everybody's playing that established game, and there's absolutely no sense that he has a problem with the fact that he's, you know, he's in a prison, and that these the reason he's there is because he wants them because they're imprisoned, and the material that he gets is extraordinary. And then Lomax goes, but Alan Lomax goes back in the 50s. Again, there's another series of recordings from Parchment Farm in the 50s, and again the material they gather is extraordinary. And Alan Lomax was more concerned about the social condition of the people he was recording, but mm-hmm. even he did a few things, like he copyrighted a lot of stuff that he recorded, you know, he said, in order to protect it. But, you know, he wasn't sharing that.
I think that protection idea is fascinating, because I think a lot of collectors would say that they are curating, and they are, you know,
and they the are. Only people you doing know, this is not yeah. this is not a straightforward story of creative black people getting ripped off by evil yeah. white people, because without the love and the work and the graft of these white collectors in the post-war period, this music would have been lost. And it is, you know, the corpus of recorded blues of the 20s and 30s, I think, can stand against almost any other American cultural product, you know, including mm-hmm. Hollywood cinema and, you know, and jazz. And it's very, very important. And they did real work. But at the same time, there's an ambiguity to that. I mean, what's the boundary between love and ownership? And that's what makes us interesting. You know, it's not a simple moral tale where everybody can kind of look at this and you know, tick off the naughty white appropriators, because there's something more complex happening.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's not necessarily. But I think you mentioned the Lomax going to prisons, and of course that's something we learn quite early on about Carter Wallace's family and where the money comes from.
Mm-hmm. It is out of this system of forced labor. I mean, another thing, I was writing this book over the period of 2014, 2015, when the movement for Black Lives really emerged as a major force. And, you know, it was part of this book is my way of trying to kind of give some context to why, you know, why this, you know, movement for civil rights, especially in terms of policing and the justice system, is important, because there is a complete continuity between policing techniques that are being used now and sort of mm-hmm. and the operations of local justice systems as now, and things that were developed in slavery and immediately after slavery. I think the slavery times are well known, you know, even Brits know about chattel slavery and they understand about the triangular trade. And then, you know, the emancipation happens in 1865. And then by and large, people understand, I think in the States too, people understand much less about what happened afterwards and how the system, how there was, you know, a brief moment where Black people attempted to assert their rights as voters and property owners and so on throughout the South. And people became legislators and property owners. And then there was this backlash. The Reconstruction turned into people were terrorized out of their property. The voting restrictions were brought in. And the system that we know as Jim Crow was instituted and that still to a great extent actually pertains today, I would argue. But part of an after slavery, they devised various ways to keep on exploiting Black labor. And a lot of that was to do with things like convict leasing, which was a system whereby you would be picked up for minor offenses, you know, walking in the wrong part of town, throwing dice, drunkenness, you know, real or invented minor offenses, taken to court. You're given a fine. Are you able to pay your fine, your $10 fine? You're probably not because you're poor and indigent. Well, you are then sentenced to work off your work in lieu. And these guys are then transported to labor camps of one sort or another, working on the levees, clearing brush, picking cotton in Alabama, working in the mines. And in many ways, this was worse than slavery because the owner of a chattel slave has an incentive to keep his property in good condition. So should feed him, make sure that he's, you know, in a good condition to work. If you're dealing with forced convict labor, you just extract all the work you can, and when they fall over dead, you get another one. And so the death rates in some of these camps were terrifying. I mean, the statistics are appalling, and this system really only runs out of steam in the years just after the First World War, but it was kind of going on a bit much later. And now you cut to the present day and you think about Ferguson, you know, the flashpoint for the round of protests that have happened over the last couple of years. Now, the municipality of Ferguson is a tiny little municipality, and their sole source of finance, more or less, was through fines levied by the court system. So the police were directed to go out and fine people for minor quality of life offences, the sort of things that we call broken window offences, broken tail lights, jaywalking, that kind of thing. And people were given fines. And in many cases, inability to pay the fine would lead you further into the justice system and sometimes to incarceration. But the main purpose of this was extraction of value from, you know, some of the poorest people around. And the background to the, you know, the reason that a riot would break out, that civil unrest would break out so immediately in a place like Ferguson is the constant grinding of money out of the population of Ferguson in order to keep this municipality working. And there are, you know, clear family resemblances there. I mean, I've driven around the South and you see they're not in chains anymore, but I've seen guys in prison stripes working on the roads. If you're a Louisiana state legislator, your coffee is served and your lunch is served and the floors are being cleaned by incarcerated prisoners, you know, as you work on your this year's prison budget, you know, you have a clear source of free labor that is taking place. And then the private prison system has an obvious incentive to make sure as many people as are incarcerated as possible. And in the last few years in the States, there's been a move against the sort of heavy sentences of the war on drugs, which led a lot of people into this privatized for-profit prison system. But that and these companies have directed themselves very strongly towards immigration detention. This is the boom area in American incarceration at the moment. It's immigration detention. And there's a lot of money to be made. And there is, you know, there's a lot of lobbyists in there. And there is an incentive to put human bodies into this pipeline and extract profit from them. And so I see an absolute continuity between, you know, this historical mode of exploitation and present day modes of exploitation. I mean, you know, Michelle Alexander famously wrote this book called The New Jim Crow about mass incarceration and the prison system. And that perspective is beginning to kind of take hold across, you know, a lot of places in America. But it's, you know, there's a very, very hard fight to be had because there's a lot of people making money out of this.
And also perhaps a lot of people, because it's about the stories Americans tell themselves and that we tell ourselves about America, that having to acknowledge this
I mean, that's one reason that I think a kind of ghost story is quite a good way. I mean, it's no accident that a lot of American horror stories and ghost stories take place on the old Indian burial ground. You know, you think of The Shining. You know, and why should that be the case? Because that's the main thing we're repressing that might force its way back up, the genocide of Native Americans. And I think slavery is the other sort of primal sin of the Republic. And it was very shocking to me when I moved there. And, you know, I consider myself an informed person and I, you know a certain amount of American history. But I didn't understand quite how hard a lot of white Americans find it to acknowledge what was done. And anyone attempting to make them acknowledge that is accused of sort of wanting to make people feel guilty, kind of, you know, rubbing their noses in something that they had nothing to do with because, you know, they weren't alive at that time. And, you know, the resistance to moving on is much deeper than I understood. I don't know if you've been following the events around the removal of Confederate statues in the South lately, but I mean, there's an extraordinary speech by the mayor of New Orleans. Mitch Landrieu gave this speech about why he's ordered three prominent Confederate statues to be taken down, and the resistance amongst people, white people on the right, to the monuments of the Confederacy being removed is extraordinary. You know, you had all the kind of outright kiddies with their torchlight procession in, I think it was Charlottesville, and in New Orleans there have been protests as well. And Landrieu points out that these monuments were put up after the Confederacy had lost in the Civil War as part of this effort to remind a newly freed black population of who was still in charge, that the heroes were the heroes of that side, not the other side.
It feels strange to move on from that point because it is so crucial to the whole book. And as you say, it's a story, it's a haunting, and it's also a possession in some ways, is core to the book. But I wanted to return briefly to the idea of authenticity and the collector ideal. Is that authenticity something that's increasingly hard to grasp in an era when it's almost hard to justify owning a physical copy of anything?
But having said that, we're buying more hardcover books than ever before. People are buying vinyl. People are beginning to fetishize the thing, the material thing, the non-digitizable thing, in a way that is, I think, directly related to the sort of liquefaction of everything by the digital. You know, we have this. I mean, in my lifetime, I'm 47, and so I came up at a point where there was no internet, and I remember the difficulty of getting hold of your subcultural signifiers, whether that was a piece of clothing or a record or whatever it was that you wanted to have in order to show that you were, you know, into a particular scene. And you had to schlep around record stores or whatever. And a generation or two older than me, you know, if you were a Brit, you wanted a pair of blue jeans, do you want to be a rock and roller, you had to go to a port and find an American sailor who might want to sell you a pair. And I'm told that in the 50s in London, if you saw another guy wearing jeans, you went over and talked to him because that was, he was probably into the same stuff you were. You know, whereas now we can kind of, the distance between me first hearing about a band and me playing the music is, just as long as it takes me to type into the search box. And I think that's devalued a certain sort of subculture. You know, now people are very nostalgic for the kind of tribal subcultures that used to be around in Britain, even into the 80s when I was a kid, I was a teeny mod and then people were casuals and stuff like that. Yeah. You know, punks and new wave and all that. And people don't have that tribal belonging in the same way anymore because everything can be so easily shuffled and reshuffled. And instead we have this figure of the hipster who is defined not so much by particular symbols but by a kind of speed of appropriation of symbols, or almost like speed of consumption of symbols. You know, the hipster is somebody who, you know, has to carry on. It's a sort of, you know, endless, you know, if you stop treading, you know, you stop like a shark, you know, you stop swimming, you're gonna die. And it is about the new rather than a particular new thing. So we're in a strange relationship to authenticity in that we crave it. You know, it's the crack that the culture thrives on, but the cycle of its commodification and excretion is, you know, many times quicker than it used to be. You know, I mean, I remember a few years ago when file sharing was a new thing, a friend of mine ran kind of file sharing meetup, sort of guerrilla, you know, swapping of pirate material. And only about four people turned up, and two of those turned out to be professional cool hunters. We were, you know, and so there's the kind of tendrils of the, you know, of the of the culture machine are, you know, are sensitive and are in every crack. So, you know, there's a, you know, I don't know where that leaves us. I think, I mean, it leaves us with things like normcore, like a kind of, you know, rejection of that whole wish for, you know, defining yourselves by symbols. You know, I'm just going to dress in chain store clothes and I'm not going to try and present any sort of front to you at all. But we're, you know, we are in a, I mean, but we still seem to care about authenticity. I mean, and why, you know, we still want it, even as it sort of recedes tantalizingly into the horizon. I mean, you could even think of it as a, you know, as something that's a sort of, it's a motivating factor that we never quite achieve. You know, none of us achieves full authenticity, but we quest after it.
And there's a curious sense right in the past few years where, again, we come back to the culture of the African American South being the most authentic, you know, if you go to anywhere in Brooklyn or Brooklyn to Dalston, and it's fried chicken and biscuits and gravy. Mm-hmm. Everywhere you go, it's still seen as the acme of the authentic.
And yeah, and that's directly the you know, to do with these blues collectors, and you know that's their you know, that's how they plug this into the culture. You know, every time you see a beer advert, and you know the old guy's tapping his foot on the porch and blowing his harmonica, and you know that's the shorthand for authentic Americana. I mean, the South is a place of the new as well. I mean, one thing that was interesting to me to discover in the course of researching this book was that the Mississippi Delta, which I think, you know, in a sort of lazy way, one tends to think of as the sort of origin of this authenticity in the early years of the 20th century. That was a new place. That place wasn't even cleared of swamp until after slavery had finished. Mm-hmm. And it was a, it's a big flat river bottom land that was an agribusiness place. And it was interesting because a lot of people could go and get work there. So it was mobile people. And it was a kind of new class of slightly, you know, more itinerant workers were coming into that place. I mean, eventually everybody, mm-hmm. you know, went north to Chicago and those kind of things happened. But you know, there's a Robert Johnson lyric where he says, you know, he says, bury my body by the highway side so my old evil spirit can get in the Greyhound bus and ride. And this sort of wish for movement and the wish for the new was part of that thing of the blues. So, you know, when you point to these bluesmen and say, oh, you're the kind of ultimate, you know, son of the soil. No, these guys, as far as they're concerned, they were the flash new guys who were kind of riding the rails and circulating. And, you know, the modern South is very different. I mean, the modern South is, you know, Jackson has a rapper called Big Crit, and there's a big hip hop tradition in, you know, across the South into Texas and places mm-hmm. like that. And, but because of the politics of the place, there are pockets where people, I mean, there are plenty of pockets of, in this Mississippi where people don't, they're not on the electricity grid and they don't have access to clean water. There are counties in Mississippi where people do not have running water, which is truly shocking in the context of, you know, the richest. I mean, there's never been wealth mm-hmm. like there is in America now. I mean, the apogee of American wealth is, you know, is unprecedented in history, and yet the distribution is so uneven. You know, we're back to the social relations of the Gilded Age, you know, before even the First World War. I mean, I think statistically all the kind of rich and poor gaps are now operating at about that level. So it's as if the labor movement of the 20th century has been, all the gains have been wiped out.
I think that'd be a terrifyingly grim but appropriate place
nice
to leave it.
Uplifting end.
Harry Kunzru's White Tears is in shops now and very worth reading. Thank you, Harry.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, or even a lot, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff, like research and testing to create shoes from natural materials, like leather made from plants, eucalyptus tree fiber, and sugarcane. It's not rocket science. It's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com today. That's Allbirds.com.